traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Prices start at $9 per month. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode was recorded on January 18th, and a highlight clip of actionable items was distributed to premium subscribers the following day. Premium subscribers then got the full podcast episode without any of these annoying ads or announcements a day after that. To take advantage of this, you can become a premium subscriber yourself. It is quite easy to do, quite affordable as well. You can visit the website mentioned at the outset, which is contrarian.supercast.com, or you can join our Substack, contrarianpod.substack.com. There are a bunch of other benefits as well, including the daily Contrarian briefing that goes out every market day morning by 7 a.m. So take advantage, contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.com. Now on with this week's guest episode. Here you go.
I'm here with Mike Edwards, Deputy CIO of Weiss Multi-Strategy Advisors. The third person here from Weiss over the last couple of years that has come on, all with quite contrarian views that they have discussed, each one a little different. And you, we are here today, first of all, to kick off your view on China and the China reopening and what this means for the global economy and for markets, which I'm assuming are good things. So take it away. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think if we kind of come into 23, now we're a few weeks into the year, but if we come in with, I think, a consensus view being, you know, basically soft landing or hard landing, but significant slowdown and concern shifting to recession. And that also, I think, echoes a little bit with growing, maybe we won't say complacency, but at least comfort with the inflation picture. One of the biggest, I think, unquestionably, if the biggest changes over the last few weeks, let's say between Thanksgiving or between the end of November and today, the biggest changes are probably China's COVID policy and some policies that rhyme with that, that maybe we'll talk about. I think I would argue the weather in Europe. And I think with that, we're starting to see a reluctant acceptance of, okay, some of the inflationary pressures are coming down, and then we're focused on a recession question. But I think that in general, there's been slow or reservations about both the degree and confidence with which the Chinese economy is reopening. And I mean that both in the sense of borders reopening, domestic borders and, you know, out of lockdown, as well as international borders, but then also a sort of reopening of economic activity through confidence transmission and the like, and more predictable policy. We feel like this is a very, very authoritative U-turn, and that the, at least as relates to what certainly PMIs in the, you know, globally are going to look like 2 to 3 months from now, it's going to have a major positive impact. I don't want to make that sound like this is therefore we're contrarian in the sense of being unreservedly bullish exclusively, because we do think over time this will also impact the global inflation picture. So just as we're seeing deflationary forces elsewhere, we're starting to see China as a countervailing force. And so I guess if I had to articulate what is it that we disagree with, it's the degree to which China is now effectively asynchronous with the rest of the world. And that can be offsetting at times, and it can be inflaming at other times.
Right. And so you say asynchronous in terms of they are expanding economically while everybody else is contracting, or in what sense?
Well, I would have said, and I should say, a lot of this commentary is as much from a policy lens as it is sort of parsing the data daily and weekly. But what I mean by that is they, from every imaginable policy perspective, monetary, fiscal, regulatory, are being accommodative,
right,
and trying to engineer growth, animal spirits, et cetera, at a time when most other developed market central banks are being intentionally restrictive, tightening, or being pressed in that direction. And you can even see that's not just global. I mean, even in region, the sort of battle against the battle with the Bank of Japan, as it were, from is, you know, is it rhymes with that. Nobody is questioning whether or not, you know, an accommodative policy from the PBOC and a reopening, you know, is how long will it last? That's not a question that, you know, when there's no, you know, sort of metaphor to yield curve control being applied to China.
Okay. So China had their zero COVID policy last year. And then there was some noise, I guess, in the fall that they would move away from it. And now they effectively or completely have, right? And so talk us through what exactly that means.
So, and the talk in the fall, I think I would characterize it as being, you know, anticipating the NPC, the National People's Congress, which was sort of the re-coronation or the coronation of Xi Jinping as, you know, kind of emperor for life, mostly metaphorically. They didn't. There was some disappointment on that front where they sort of stayed restrictive with the population. And there are a bunch of reasons for that, which we don't need to go into. The change was really in November. Following harsher lockdowns, you also had, and I don't, what I'm about to say, I don't want to make this sound like it's purely causal. I think it's contributory without being causal. But you also had protests over overly severe lockdowns. And to me, that was suggestive, not just that the zero COVID policy in and of itself was a problem, or that, you know, we all want to get COVID, obviously not. I think there's but that the secondary consequences, I'd like to think mostly unintentional, of restrictions had just both in duration and in degree had gotten too severe. Mm-hmm. And to see protests of any kind in mainland China is totally remarkable. And I think, again, I don't think it was per se causal, but it was a reflection of the degree of frustration that the population had. And you can see that from an economic data standpoint and the way that it translates into markets, the degree of excess savings, the complete shutdown in activity. I mean, these are all symptoms of the same malaise. And, you know, the irony here is I'm making a disease metaphor, and then we're talking about, okay, let's get the disease and then let's get over it, right? And I don't want to make light of the, you know, undoubtedly hundreds of thousands of deaths that are being caused by this. By this reversal, although I would posit that, you know, it is actually it was almost inevitable. Like there was not a path through COVID without a large part of the Chinese population getting COVID, and they just sort of got it over with, as it were. It's the thing that's remarkable about this for markets. So we've been talking about how quickly things changed is just the sharpness of the U-turn in policy. Yeah. I mean, it was. Within the span of a week, you had officials saying, I mean, officials, not like man on the street, saying zero COVID, zero COVID, zero COVID, to masks off, do what you want. And the language, which I think is actually really important in terms of market psychology, it went from we, the central, provincial, municipal government, are telling you what is safe and what is not. We are responsible for you, to take responsibility for yourself. You decide what's best for you, right? Now, that's very easy to interpret and see the implications in a health standpoint, because we've all been through, you know, through COVID, and we've also all been armchair epidemiologists and whatever. But if you translate that to the economic sphere, where a lot of the sort of repression of the last year has been in the language, the language in Chinese policy of common prosperity and things like that. It's, you know, if you kind of parse through that, it's, we are going to decide what's best for the society and we will make changes accordingly. And other than that, all bets are off, like from a wealth accumulation, from a corporate organization, et cetera, all of those standpoints. And here you're starting to see broader economic policy mirror that language of individual responsibility. You're seeing a lot of the hallmarks of that tech crackdown have been reversed. I think the I've said before that I think like the we now have kind of bookends to that. Where we started was Ant, you know, Alibaba wanted to sub IPO Ant Financial and they got a little ahead of their skis and they were slapped, right? Didi IPO'd, they did their IPO in the US and they had some data issues, et cetera, and they were completely shut down, kicked out of the App Store. Well, guess what's happened in the last 3 weeks? Ant Financial just raised a bunch of cash that is generally considered to be kind of a pre-IPO maneuver and they're sort of back in good graces. Jack Ma has pretty much relinquished claim to control of Alibaba, which is a good sign. And guess what? Didi's back in the app stores. Like we're starting to see that a lot of those, and the symbolism here matters more than the specific company occurrence that we might be talking about. A lot of that has really completely reversed at this point. And so I think those are some of the signposts that for us suggest that we've done a U-turn and we are going to accelerate from here rather than thinking about it as cautiously waiting to see if that U-turn, you know, turns into a roundabout or we just keep going with a policy unpredictability mindset.
Yeah. Now, a couple of questions on this. I mean, first of all, this is not pre-pandemic China. And well, more importantly, it's not pre-2016 China or 2017, right? Yeah. You have a very clear policy objective, it would seem, that was not unique to Trump to kind of stop or lessen the trade and the impact and the ties, I guess, economically between the US and China. There's a whole bunch of geopolitical stuff going on over Taiwan, et cetera. We don't need to get into that. But, and then you also have the real estate sector in China that is apparently in a lot of trouble. I mean, it wasn't that long ago we were seeing headlines over Evergrande and all these other ones. And are those not concerns where it comes to China revamping and being able to launch itself again economically?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more in terms of those being long-term concerns. You know, I think quite famously, I don't remember exactly when it was last year, a couple of Western investment banks, including most prominently JP Morgan, described China as uninvestable.
Right.
And I think for real duration, let's call it multi-year investments, I think that statement actually remains true. And there are reasons why following the National People's Congress, as we talked about, that should be reinforced for folks in terms of the unpredictability of personnel and in the long term that disconnect, the sort of from a U.S. perspective, the de-Chinification of supply chains and the sort of capex boom we're seeing globally to accomplish that. Your point on and inevitably we're getting into some of the kind of geopolitical aspects of this. But I think one of the things that actually accelerated that in 2022 was the, probably regrettable. And when I say regrettable, I mean from their own perspective, Chinese support for, Putin's adventure in Ukraine. And some of it was overt and some of it was support through silence or what have you. But, there was a lot of alienation that happened as a result. I think it remains problematic. I also think from a long-term standpoint, the U.S. perspective on this and, sort of asset flows that would be heavily influenced by U.S. preferences to disconnect from China are that ship has sailed. We're not reversing that force. Yeah. My view is not that this is a dawn of a new, we're going to return to 12% growth and you have to be there for that. Right. I would say just one more comment on sort of the external environment for that before getting into the property sector is that, I think that environment, so the restrictions and constraints on ex-China investment in China is actually probably getting worse, not better. And in particular, I think, one of the very few things in the U.S. that both parties agree on is that China's a problem, right? Mm-hmm. So in terms of things that can happen in this Congress or for the next 2 years in an environment where very little, let's be frank, is going to happen, whether it's from the administration or congressionally, you know, being hard on China is absolutely one of those things. And one of the tools that hasn't been deployed yet is the idea of, some people refer to it as outbound CFIUS, or review of investment flows into China. And to me, that even the consideration of that can have a cooling effect, right? Because if you think of it, I mean, obviously we at Weiss are a, you know, public equity, very liquid firm, but if you just put yourself in the shoes of a, you know, a longer term EM investor, or a growth, like a, even like mezzanine debt to companies, where you might have a 5 to 10 year horizon. If somewhere during that period, your portfolio might get reviewed by the Department of Commerce, who's looking at, you know, follow that through, you're going to think twice about that allocation. And even the sort of like the pre-considerations are going to have a chilling effect. And I think we're in that phase. So I don't think, in terms of the dependability of asset flows, as well, like repatriation has always been a problem. It's even more of a problem if you think this is worse. I think that's a massive concern. And so our being, you know, sort of contrarian constructive on the China reopening right now, I consider to be a macro phenomenon that impacts markets sort of in the moment, and absolutely is going to impact global data and economic activity at a very, very important time when expectations are moving sort of in an asynchronous way, to use my earlier term.
Yeah.
The other big problem in China that you point out is the property sector is a disaster. You know, I think it's not the prettiest metaphor, but I think what they're doing right now, as far as trying to accommodate developers through financing and ease up on some of the prior restrictions for, you know, taking out mortgages and second homes and things like that, the so-called three red lines. I think the what they're doing right now to repair that, it's like putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. It's like,
yeah.
This is like, okay, like you might stop the bleeding for a short period of time, but we're major surgery is required. It's a huge problem. The dependency of, you know, financial flows in general, consumer balance sheets, municipal and provincial finance, and the fiscal picture all being dependent on this sort of spinning wheel. I'm trying to use a term other than the word Ponzi, right? But all that dependency is it's a huge problem. And so I think there's not a very obvious solution that doesn't involve a very long horizon and some pain. If I were to be a little bit glass half full on that story, and this isn't so much predictive as I would give my own kind of subjective view of, if I were advising let's say the CSRC and the CBRC and the PBOC in Beijing, I would suggest that what they have to sort of deepen financial markets and create non-property stores of wealth, equities, you know, credit, more securitization, functioning secondary credit markets, places for people to generate wealth that don't involve buying a second and third apartment. That's just vital. And if they pull that off, that'll be quite interesting. But they're a long way from even trying, let alone, you know, pulling it off.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
Okay, well that aside, let's walk through this shorter term China reopening and how this plays out in asset markets.
Yeah.
I'm assuming this is going to be very good for commodities, because China is the biggest consumer of you know, these raw materials. Right. And we've already seen oil and copper over the last week or two shoot up. So, yeah, is that
more so than oil? Right?
Yeah. So, yeah. So talk to me about that. How does that translate into that in terms of asset prices?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, I certainly think you've started to see those expectations priced in. I do think, I don't want to get in, dive down too many rabbit holes here, but the copper versus oil differential, to the extent that we can derive the China reopening as being a motivating force here, I struggle with it a little bit, because we already touched on property. The I don't think we're on the dawn of a new wave of property demand and like the resurgence of, you know, iron ore mines in the Pilbara to put steel into, you know, ever higher towers in Guangzhou, right? I do not think that that is, you know, my own prediction, but also I don't think that's in the consensus mindset, as it were. I think it's a little bit more of a knee jerk. And the same sort of discussion we had a minute ago about the, you know, the restrictions on some global managers through kind of an ESG lens of like chasing the China reopening story without actually buying Chinese assets. Like, to your point, what are you going to buy if you want to chase the China reopening? Well, let's buy copper. I don't know that that's happening. There's a little bit of evidence in sort of the, some of the positioning data, but not enough to be conclusive. That, to me, is more kind of anecdotal and is a, it's a question worth asking. Okay. Does that have legs? Sure. Why not? I mean, I think we're probably, you know, away from, we're definitely not at a turn anymore. And we're at a sort of, okay, how far can this go? I think where this will show up more clearly, and it has started to, but show up more clearly and with more follow through is going to be in global markets, both top down and bottom up, that have exposure to the Chinese consumer versus don't. And I do think this is a consumer story.
Okay.
In the first instance. So I was actually at lunch earlier and was talking through a similar topic, but think about just as an easy for people who don't follow different global securities or whatever, think about just the way Starbucks might behave versus McDonald's. Starbucks has a bigger pound for pound presence in China. That's not a recommendation one way or the other, but thinking about how, you know, European luxury has a lot more exposure than low end apparel elsewhere, right?
Yeah.
And that's sort of a bottom up view, top down view. And we're also seeing this, it points to Europe and parts of EM outperforming the US for
real. Really? That's contrarian. Okay.
Well, I'm okay with that. I'll embrace that as a contrarian view. Europe has significantly more, both, you know, corporate exposure to the Chinese market on a percentage basis than the US does. Right. Both in the, you know, sort of real time, you know, sort of just parsing through revenue and also on a capitalized basis. Mm-hmm. It's not even close. I mean, I'm thinking about this as much through a policy lens as anything, but I would note that in this same push we've been talking about the US disconnecting from China and the export ban on semiconductors and things like that, you know who's pushing back on that? Mark Rutte, the PM of the Netherlands, was in the White House yesterday saying, you know what, not so fast, right? We have ASML, we have other chip makers that depend heavily on China, and, like, you know, to a degree we're joining you, but we're not just cutting off our Chinese revenue. It's pretty damn You're starting to hear more and more of that on the continent, and I think it's indicative of, I mean, you were sort of asking the question who benefits, but I think those policy preferences are indicative of you know, sort of industrial organization more broadly and those exposures. So I do think
interesting.
I think what we've seen in, I mean, Europe's outperformed the US in November, December, and January.
Yeah.
I think there, in my estimation, there are two very big reasons for that. One of them is the China discussion we've had. They've done a reversal. Europe has more exposure. And then, of course, the other was the other surprise I mentioned, which is warmer, you know, the Ukraine conflict, terrible as it is, has sort of reached a, you know, steady, frozen, awful, but frozen state. And the dependency on, on hydrocarbon inputs that could continue to be skyrocketing in price has waned because they've fixed some of the infrastructure, and it's been a very warm winter so far. So, you know, a lot of prognostication in the summer was like, if it's a cold winter, it's going to be a disaster. Well, the flip side, you know, also holds. So that's where I think you're seeing some European outperformance. And I think without making any predictions about the Ukraine-Russia conflict, looking through the China lens, I think that view is extensible. I think, you know, the Europe over US is a worthwhile preference.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned some of the companies that have a lot of exposure to China. You know, Starbucks is one. By the way, the biggest Starbucks in the world, you may know, is in, or at least was in Shanghai, Disneyland in Shanghai, if I'm not mistaken. And for a while there, Harold Schultz, every quarterly report that you'd read about that you'd read from Starbucks was about China. It was like the first thing, but this is like years ago. But anyway, and then of course the European luxury goods makers too, like, and cars, right? Like these are all things that,
I mean, the, on their quarterly call, Prada was citing stats on hotel occupancy in Hainan.
Right. But these aren't these things, because we saw this during the pandemic in the US where like, okay, like in-store retail dried up, but people still bought stuff. They just ordered it online and had it delivered. And didn't you have the same effect in China or less so?
I think somewhat less so, certainly from a services standpoint.
Yeah, yeah.
Travel standpoint, you think about the global impact of Chinese tourism is enormous.
Absolutely.
And I think you could rightly ask the question, okay, well, is this just revenge spending and people are going to do their one, you know, post-COVID trip and then that's it? What I would point to as a major and probably undercovered feature of this change is that, you know, there was in fact zero COVID in China for like 2 years. The better part of 2 years, meaning the second half of 2020 through April of 22-ish, right? And yet, I'm not making a subjective statement when I say here for good reason, meaning they justified it. Chinese borders remain closed. Some would say for control purposes. Some would say it's sort of that's the Xi regime of the future. And others would say it's, you know, epidemiologically driven and they didn't want to import COVID. Okay. They're not mutually exclusive rationales. Chinese borders are now open. The China-Hong Kong border is porous.
Yeah.
If you're in Shanghai, you can book a flight to anywhere in the world mostly through Hong Kong, but all the same, they are issuing passports and visas again. And in fact, ironically, there was some blowback because we don't need to get into it, but they halted some visa issuance to foreigners because they'd required COVID testing of Chinese that were traveling there, et cetera. Right. But that's a complete change from over the 3 years, not since the April lockdowns or since the NPC or anything else like that. So, you know, I think we could quibble a little bit with, okay, is the next, let's imagine that we don't have another wave and we really emerge in the next couple of weeks and over Lunar New Year and whatever, is that going to hold steady for 3 or 4 or 5? I don't know. But I do not think that it's just a one-off in terms of the resurgence of Chinese travel and services. So I think that is a qualitative difference to the US COVID experience.
Yeah. And to your point, Europe is closer to China than the US is, and probably maybe a little more accessible from a visa perspective, depending on where you go for Chinese tourists. So there's a part of that. And then you would think that these regional, you know, air carriers and other kind of tourism companies in Asia could be good, big time benefit.
I think hotels as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, right. I mean, and Macau. I mean, the whole trade in Macau.
That's you've seen that starting to get priced in. There's a lot of parts. There's a lot of moving parts there. Yeah. But yeah, I think there's all of the above.
Interesting. Okay. Cool. All right. Let's shift real quick to the U.S. here, and we had some kind of good news, bad news this morning. We had producer prices coming quite soft, which means inflation maybe probably is ebbing. And on the other side of that, the bad news is we had a retail report or retail sales that came in well below forecasts. Now, I believe that was the month over month. I'm not sure about the year over year, but how do you see that? And you know, because part of this is, especially if you're talking about European retail or, you know, producers, they need U.S. consumers just as much as they need Chinese ones. So if U.S. Retail is kind of starting to slow here, that would be a big concern, one would think. So what's your views on that?
Yeah, so I think it's starting to rhyme. It's not just the retail data. I mean, we got the Empire, which was pretty remarkably weak. So I think even on the, you know, kind of producer and small business side, you're seeing that softness as well. I think it's too soon to draw a conclusion. But to me, from a, you know, at least as far as the debate in and I'll come back to the European question in a moment, but I think the debate as far as US valuations, I think it is less about the sort of immediate economic data and more about the Fed's response to it.
Right.
Because I think the biggest unanswered question right now is not, it's not how high in terms of rates. It's for how long. So it's a duration question. And so maybe counterintuitively, you know, I think I'm not sure that we're sort of past the point of doing the 25 versus 50 debate for the Fed meeting. Like, we're going to do that. But I think it's, I think consensus is like, there's either 50 or 75 bips more to go, right? I could be wrong a little bit, but it really is sort of for how long. And if we start to see softness, then the market may get more comfortable that the heavy lift is done, and we can take the Fed can take its foot off, so to speak.
Right.
So I think that's what we're starting to get. Like, that is why we're going to have to get multiple data points. We're not going to draw a conclusion in one day. And I think it's also why you're starting to get like the thing that's convincing, you know, bears to reverse themselves, or people are reluctantly putting risk back on. I think there are a number of things, but the biggest is that the environment's getting more predictable. Vol is coming down. And so if the sort of, in, I said before, people are this soft landing, hard landing debate, if sort of, you know, Godot is arriving, right? And like, oh my God, we're getting softness. That's something to sink our teeth into. Counterintuitively, that can actually push vol lower. We're not seeing problems in credit spreads, and the VIX is behaving itself. So that's all, to me, is sort of forcing risk taking right now. And that is, I think, really important, not just for the near-term risk environment, but also in starting to think longer term, where the bigger question to me is going to be, if we pull off if that is sort of a one-off and everybody backs off and things, kind of firm up for a non-recessionary first quarter, first half, and then the shift goes to, okay, but then what? Then you have a problem of like, okay, but can the Fed actually let up? And we get to the second order considerations. But that's at least the way that we're thinking about softer data now, as being sort of an articulation of how bad can be good.
Yeah.
I take your point on, you know, Europe relying on a strong European consumer, sorry, strong US consumer, strong global consumer. But right now, I think the European debate is as much around input prices and in inflation.
Yeah.
And I think the moves in nominal growth are so large right now, or, you know, the nominal pieces are so large that you can be forgiven a monthly fall off in this case, retail expense, because it's all so noisy. But I think that on the European side, again, I think when we're still sitting here talking about, you know, CPI and a 10 handle coming down to a 9 handle, that's the big, that to me is the bigger debate in those markets. And seeing that change is what's starting to inspire, or what has been inspiring risk-taking in Europe.
Yep. Yeah. And of course, the energy situation and the weather. But it doesn't sound like you're particularly worried about the Fed anymore. I mean, last year at this time, everybody was freaking out, rightfully so, as it turned out, about the Fed. And we had all these rate hikes, 75 basis points, 4 times, was it? Yeah. But it doesn't sound like you're all that concerned about the Fed anymore this year.
I mean, I think we're well past the point of peak Fed fear. That's not a reason to be. I mean, I am not contrarian with respect to the don't fight the Fed adage at all. And there's no doubt that the Fed wants to see financial conditions tighter. And by tighter, I mean tighter than they were and probably tighter than they are. But as far as what the market is telling us about the opportunity, you know, we made lows in equity markets in June. You know, the 10-year is materially lower right now than it was last June. So like we've priced it all in. It's there. We're sort of, that's not to say that there's not still laughter among the audience at the joke, but at least the joke is getting told. And now I think it's to digestion. And I do think the questions are around, will there be a recession? And if so, with what depth? And, you know, and I think if we're then splitting hairs, are we talking about, you know, both corporate earnings and labor, or is there sort of, because the labor is so scarce and pricing power is so great, could this be some sort of an asterisk with corporate earnings falling off materially? But, you know, anyway, we don't need to go down that particular debate. But that's where I think the we've shifted to in terms of the relevant question for markets.
Mm-hmm. And what's your view on that, your house view?
Our house view is that we are unlikely to have a recession in
at all. Okay.
In this year. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
Between labor shortage and something and reasonable resiliency of, again, everything happens in a nominal world here, but of nominal corporate earnings. I would not say that we're complacent, but we are encouraged by the, you know, in addition to this, the inputs that we've talked about that have changed over the last months, that the, you know, China going from what has basically been at the beginning of this year, and I'm talking 3 weeks ago, a negative GDP run rate to, you know, targeting something in the mid single digits, like that is going to unlock a lot of consumer activity, a lot of credit and liquidity. And that's a pretty powerful counterforce to, you know, a lot of what we've been talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And you certainly made that point so far today. All right, Mike Edwards, very interesting conversation here. I want to take a short break and then come back and move on to our second segment of the show, where I ask you about your personal background, how you came to this state of your career. But let's first take a short break, give our sponsors a quick chance to be heard. And if you are a premium subscriber, do not touch the dial. You'll not get the break. We'll be right back. In fact, we already are. And everybody else, if you want to become a premium subscriber, visit the website contrarianpod.substack.com and sign up.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host and access to private channels on our Discord server. They also get generous discounts to our virtual conferences and other services. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information. That's contrarian.supercast.tech.
By the way, you don't need the .tech suffix to get to that website. .com will do the trick. And we also have a Substack that you can, where you can sign up for the same prices, same benefits, same details. contrarianpod.substack.com. So if you already have a Substack account and use it, or have the app and use that, that's probably the best way to go. So contrarian.supercast.com or contrarianpod.substack.com, whole bunch of benefits, including, of course, getting this episode up to a week early without ads or annoying announcements. And you also get the Daily Contrarian briefing and podcast that is released every market day morning at 7 a.m. This is a contrarian take on the events of the day ahead and what is likely to move markets, such as economic data releases, earnings, and other things. It is really good, and that is completely unbiased, of course. So check that out, contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.tech. Now on with the show. All right, welcome back, everybody. Mike Edwards, Weiss Multi-Strategy Advisors, the deputy CIO there. Mike, this is I touched on it, the segment of the show where we talk to our guests about his background and how he came to this station of his career. So take us back a little bit. What is your origin story here, and to put it into Marvel terms here, with investing, and how do you end up over at Weiss?
Yeah, so I you could probably hear from a lot of what I say, I tend to take a policy view on a lot of things. As an undergrad, I was actually a policy major at the, what is no longer called the Wilson School. It's now the
Princeton?
Yeah. Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. I probably got that wrong, but yeah. When I was there, that's what it was called. When I was in college, I sort of figured I would be I'd be in the public sector in some form, and those were what all my internships were. And my disappointment is it's pretty hard to find people to learn from, particularly at the sort of intersection of, you know, finance and policy in the public sector. And there's a you know, there's a tried and true path of people who, you know, do that stuff later, as it were. And I ended up doing that despite not thinking that. I started my career outside of that actually as a as an M&A banker in the tech sector.
Oh, wow.
I worked for Frank Quattrone's team at out on the West Coast. This is right during the, you know, sort of 2001, 2002 era, the height of and then the end of the tech boom. So
yeah, I remember.
Particularly in M&A, you can imagine that was pretty busy. pretty busy time. And I had also, which will kind of get to the next segment, I had, as an undergrad, I'd spent a lot of time in China. I speak Chinese.
Oh, wow.
Speak Mandarin, and had done some of that when as a banker. I went to the buy side to D.E. Shaw, which is, I assume many of your listeners know who that is. When I joined D.E. Shaw, which was in the early 2000s, they were almost exclusively a quant job, and they were sort of starting to recruit discretionary people. And we called the team that I worked on, we called it special situations, because you didn't use an algorithm for it was special. So it was kind of great. But I ended up with D.E. Shaw spending a fair amount of time in China as well. That was, I guess you could say it was a special situation, but
yeah,
deepening that and helping a lot of the efforts there. And you know, that was actually a very important development. It'll get us a building block to how I came to Weiss, in that I had to learn to, you know, use data a lot and to quantify just about any view that I had. Not just because that's a good discipline and it's important, but as a process matter, the way that we actually deployed investments was by communicating quantified forecasts about securities.
Hmm.
So it was literally signals communicated, as you could boil them down to, you know, effectively mu and sigma, right? And so metaphorically speaking, Greek, but was really that was a very, very important discipline for me in terms of realizing that anything can be quantified and everything should be measured, which is, especially that latter part, is something that we take very seriously at Weiss and are very invested in, you know, data science and analytics. We have baseball cards. You can think of that in a kind of Moneyball sense, but of, you know, a lot of measurement in that regard. After D.E. Shaw, I ran the U.S. business for a London-based firm. And then I came here to Weiss in 2019 to join Jordy, who's, I believe, has been on the Contrarian Pod as well. And I'd known Jordy for quite a while before that, and really had a lot of resonance for his, or resonance with, rather, his view on kind of marrying culture and technology. Weiss is a well-established firm. We've been around for 45 years, and we have, you know, a lot of folks who I think are, you know, sort of very mature investors. And I mean that descriptively in terms of their approach, not necessarily their age, but with a lot of intellectual curiosity, and marrying that intellectual curiosity with the technology to measure and help PMs adapt to market environments, and kind of emphasizing that adaptability was something that you know, I have viewed as being incredibly important. It was a huge effort of Jordy's, and starting to build a more scalable business around that is something that I joined in 2019 to help with, and that's a part of my remit. And another part of my remit is obviously helping to to craft and curate some of our broader, macro views, or most of our micro deployments, or, you know, the remit of individual PMs who are here. But we do have a pretty both transparent, and I'd like to think, cohesive, in the sense of joining units to debate views, not necessarily having a house view that we do not have a house view that everybody implements. But we do have a house view on market dynamics all of our teams need to be aware of, and to be, you know, thinking about in terms of, on the one hand, the cost of being wrong, on the other hand, the opportunity of you know, to harness the word projected behind you, of being contrarian and of knowing when you're providing liquidity and when you're consuming it. And we want to be liquidity providers. So that's sort of part of the mindset that I was certainly very drawn to, and I'd like to think I help.
Very cool. That's really interesting. Wow. So policy through M&A banker, through D.E. Shaw, which was kind of like one of the original quant hedge funds, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
David Shaw, through Weiss. That's quite, and China thrown in there as well.
Yeah, I think I could give you a slightly more, I know that seems a bit random to hear you sort of hit it back to me. I will say, since I started with the policy discussion, you know, one of the common threads through that are, you know, I really think the inflection points in markets, both at the macro level and sometimes at the micro level as well, which I'll come back to, a lot of times sit at the intersection of policy, regulatory decisions, sometimes geopolitics, and the sort of reflexivity with markets and pricing. And I have a lot of time, I've really gravitated to the parts of markets that are, you know, sort of the tip of the spear there. So on a micro basis, I mentioned sort of special situations at D. Shaw and things I've done since then. A lot of that has been, you could think of it as event-driven investing and risk arbitrage and things like that, that are heavily reliant on having, you know, views, legal work, regulatory work, views on policy regimes, sometimes overseas. That includes, you know, things done in China, including things like cross listings and some of the, you know, the bank IPOs and things like that a long time ago. But all the way to today, where, you know, I think over the last several years, a lot of the inflection points in returns in markets from a top-down standpoint have come, you know, frequently following, not necessarily anticipating, major regime changes. And I would just, I mean, if you want the, since we were talking about the China reopening, look at, you know, look at in particular November of 2020, like a monumental month in the history of markets. And, you know, that's not because Novembers are good months for things, right? That's because we had, at the same time, we had a sooner than people expected vaccine, and we had a change in administration.
Right.
You know, and understanding and helping digest the sort of the implications of that to contextualize, you know, the intersection of policy and markets, I think is a really important skill. So that's why I sort of said like, well, that's where I started. And then, you know, it was much more applied, and I'm sort of now a bit more balanced.
Wow. That's really interesting. Huh? Wow. Okay. Very cool. So what do you think is the end game here with China's one? I mean, it sounds like on the one hand, you're saying they can make this transition to a consumer economy, which they've been talking about forever. I mean, I spent some time in the region too, in Hong Kong in the mid-2010s, and that was all the talk then. And that's kind of been the thing they've been beating on for a long time.
Yeah. They keep relabeling it. Now it's the dual circulation policy, right?
What is it called now?
Dual circulation. It's the idea that you can sort of spin the domestic economy and the Chinese consumer, and, you know, export-led global economy and Belt and Road Initiative and things like that, right? Where, you know, and in my estimation, it's a sensible framing, but getting those two things to spin in the same direction at the same time is, you know, they haven't succeeded at that yet, and I don't really think they will.
Okay. So what are they, do they continue being the factory to the world, or do they just kind of become some one of these more of a hybrid type of thing?
Yeah, I think more hybrid. I think it's a much more mature economy now than it was. I don't think we're going to be back to the, you know, double digit growth phases. And in that maturing, you know, I think to a lot of fanfare this week, we've seen the results published that China's population shrank for the first time. Right. This was totally predictable. It happened a little bit sooner than people saw. But, you know, we get lost, especially market participants can easily get lost in the day-to-day flow of this news story. And if you zoom out, you know, China has gone from, you know, basically more than doubling its population over the prior 30 years to significant population declines over the coming 15 to 30 years. And you have a real graying of that population at the same time that it's a global phenomenon, obviously. Yeah. Increased longevity and both health and life expectancy. And this is, you know, it's good from a quality of life standpoint. It's a real fiscal problem for China. I do think that the conflicts and the sort of the binaries, as it were, I think a lot of them for China really are on the at the sort of bleeding edge of technological innovation. I think we miss this a lot of times, but AI, I mean, right now AI is having a moment. In general, the Chinese are pretty far along in AI. It's related, but there's a lot of evidence that at least in the public sector, which obviously the Chinese public sector is larger than the US public sector, they're further along in quantum computing. That may not actually be the case, but I think it's still Chinese advancements in quantum are very, very relevant to an information security view globally, if not just, you know, pure processing power and everything else. And I think, you know, the Chinese for the most part are further along in fintech in general.
Okay,
and I would include, sort of kind of closed blockchains in that discussion. I mean, obviously crypto per se is banned in China, but I think all of that in terms of having a, I'll call it a rich digital future, I think is actually very, very important. China had I guess it depends on you ask, and I wouldn't consider myself an expert, but you could say like China's had a mobile digital as well as a gaming culture that has led the US and led Europe in some ways. And sort of how they harvest that and where that lands. I think those are really important questions for a maturing economy. But China's emerging as a legitimately wealthy country that has, in some ways the infrastructure of a wealthy country, and in other ways, including the property market, the sort of the policy infrastructure of a totally backwards, banana republic. So
yeah. The
way they reconcile those things, I think, are the big questions. And I'm not better than glass half full, if I'm being honest. I think I think the reason why we started with China, the last 8 or 9 months have been so terrible.
Yeah.
The power of the reversal is very, very strong. Yeah. And the power of semi-normalization is very strong. But I wouldn't extend that positivity out 5 years or a decade.
Okay. All right. So you're a little skeptical, but you think they can pull this off without having the US as a major, I mean, we're still a major trading partner, but not the huge, thing that they had up until, 2017 or so.
I do think so. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think we're right now we're in sort of the CapEx phase of that de-Chinification.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The U.S. has made a very clear commitment to that. You're seeing the beneficiaries in various places in the U.S. You're seeing, Mexico is another example of a beneficiary for sure. But generally speaking, the Chinese I'm making a sweeping generalization, but the Chinese build things better and faster than the U.S. does. So to the extent that there's a mini CapEx boom that is offsetting, there's not going to be a replacement for many Chinese corporates of the U.S. consumer, but at the low end, I have no idea where the shirt you're wearing is from, but if the shirt you're wearing is from China, the same shirt you buy 5 years from, it's still going to be from China. There's not a security risk there.
Right.
It really is, maybe you won't buy the drone that you took, to video whatever, right? Maybe that won't.
Hey, how do you know about that? No, I'm kidding.
But I don't think it's a, I'm now making this up. This is not data driven, but if the average American consumer spends $1,000 on Chinese goods, they're still going to spend $600 or $700 of those $1,000 5 and 10 years from now.
Yeah.
Just that we've changed the direction of travel because that wallet, the wallet itself grew and the Chinese share of the wallet had been growing for so long. Mm-hmm. And now we've, very much from a sort of a high tech standpoint, have hit the stop button on that.
Yeah. Good points. Okay. Last question, probably. You talk about quants and having to kind of quantify everything. One of the things that, and one of the reasons for this podcast is this whole idea that like the narrative in the market is often wrong and investors are often wrong with the way they price things. And it seems to come down to greed versus fear. And I've myself played around a lot with this and trying to figure out ways of gauging how you are on that. Do you have any thoughts about that? Do you guys do any work on that there with behavioral economics, perhaps, or anything like that?
I certainly agree with your instinct that there we do sort of go from these. I mean, I think more recently, maybe we could frame the terms a little differently and harness the FOMO phenomenon.
Yes.
I realize the word fear is in the...
Well, that's just greed, isn't it?
FOMO, but it's greed by another name, right? Yeah. And sort of that versus uncertainty and unpredictability or sort of a despair. I mean, we absolutely speak linguistically a lot and try to think about broader market, sort of mentalities to think about, in a sense, what phase we're in. I wish I could tell you that there's, you know, great academic work here and there obviously is, but it's nothing that we've done. We don't have, you know, sort of in-house economists that look at that. Our behavior, just to parse that word, our behavioral approach is much more about the, you know, sort of portfolio construction and trading style of our managers to market conditions.
Okay.
Now, what is interesting about that though, is that, you know, if you think about it from a market neutral portfolio perspective or hedged, I'm trying not to use the word hedged funds, but market neutral portfolios, right, tend to do better in re-risking environments than in de-risking environments. Now, that's not necessarily directional for markets, but I think changing the language a little bit from greed and fear. But I do think that when you get into kind of chasing mentalities or places where the market is seeking confirmatory data points as opposed to binaries or weighted binaries and gets the other side, those are really important behaviorally in relatively short windows in thinking about the sort of market phase you're in and thus thinking about whether we would expect risk-taking behavior. And when I say risk-taking behavior, I mean both, dumbing it down a little bit, but both long and short, right? You can have investors adding risk and adding to their kind of gross exposures, even in down markets.
Sure.
Or down beta, right? So we think about that a little bit differently as opposed to trying to call those swings. But the importance of that is that I think I mentioned this phrase before, is that we want to be providing liquidity.
Right.
We want to be positioned ahead of that sort of phase in a market and thus providing liquidity, you know, on various different timelines. And I think that's a really important mentality for investors in general, but obviously, especially contrarian investors to take and to benefit from. I do think that trying to parse out the kind of behavioral phase that a market is in is vitally important.
Mm. What phase do you think we're at now with the expansion? Do you do the quadrant thing, 1, 2, 3, 4, or just generally?
My partner Jordy does. I don't, so I'm going to try to borrow his chops here.
Okay.
But I think generally we're at this moment in time following almost 3 weeks of, I'll just call it chasing. I think we're in a bit of a consolidation phase. That's a little, it's a bit of a cop-out to your question. But I think we have been, and for choice, we remain in a, I have to put money to work phase right now. So that's not necessarily to say chasing, but I think we're in a, vol has come down and will stay lower. And I mean, both equity vol and rates vol. And I think you're starting to see, if you just look at credit spreads and you look at the, you know, behavior in credit markets right now, you're starting to see people just trying to put money to work. And that is not a, you know, that for the most part is kind of turning a, you know, whatever not nautical metaphor you like, turning a very large ship. It's not, we're not in a tactical wait and see mode. And I think it's hard to reverse those engines, as it were.
Yeah. Do you think we'll continue? Yeah. You think we'll continue to see the kind of credit and equities or fixed income and equities kind of move the same way, the way they have been, I mean, over the past year or so?
Yeah, I mean, the correlations have obviously, you know, you can see from the performance and, yeah. You know, the, I mean, I somebody asked me earlier today, you know, is 40-60 the new 60-40?
Yeah.
I was like, well, the question kind of answers itself, doesn't it? Yeah. Right. To your point on correlations. I do think that there is more that kind of, again, risk-taking phase and a willingness to deploy as in an environment, which is the environment I do think we're in which you're having, you know, vol come down, stay higher than we might like it. Like, I don't see we're going to see low teens vol anytime soon, because as we've been discussing, there's so many unanswered questions. But I do think in that phase, there will continue to be risk put to work. And I think that, like, you know, I think it's expensive to be in cash right now, certainly considering that, you know, short-term credit carries very, very well, right?
Exactly.
So I do think that's a risk-taking mentality. So I think that is, those can be, you know, pretty decent environments for a lot of different investment styles. But I think, you know, I'd be curious your impression from other guests you've had and your own impressions. But I think, to me, you know, you're in that environment when people everything sort of feels reluctant. Like, it's not obvious that we should be pushing money out. But that reluctance generally characterizes environments in which vol continues to come down and that are more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty consistent with a lot of what we've been hearing. I mean, you know, some cautious risk taking, but. You know, at the end of the year, last year, there was a lot of talk about how the fixed income market wouldn't turn. But it appears that, I mean, who knows? It's only been a couple of weeks and we're still over 4% on the 2-year. I mean, so and the yield curve is still inverted.
Yep.
So we still have a ways to go, but yep. We've certainly come off of the highs there on the yields for sure. It would appear. Cool. All right, Mike Edwards of Weiss Multi-Strategy Advisors. Maybe in closing, you can tell our listeners where they can find out more about you if you're on any of the social media. I hope for your sake you aren't, but no, I joke because some social, I mean, I find Twitter kind of useful. That's the only one I really use, but and where else they might be able to find you.
Yeah, I think easiest is on gweiss.com. We do our own, we actually have our own podcast that we put out weekly. I'm on that with some frequency. And we put a lot of, even down to our, we call them morning seeds, but some of the high level notes from our daily morning macro meetings, we put out ahead of market open every day just for
cool.
To get a sense of what our thinking is. And that's a pretty good place to find our thinking with some regularity. I am also on, as you say, the place I'm on, you know, I guess I'm on LinkedIn as many are, but I'm on Twitter at
M Edwards underscore G Weiss. Tell me about the macro, the morning seeds thing. What time do you put that out?
Yeah, it's usually around 9:15 to 9 okay. daily. We have a 8 o'clock morning meeting.
And okay.
We take the kind of 4, 5, 6 most salient points from that and put them out every day. And it gives you a sense of where what we think is kind of top of mind for ourselves, for RPMs. It's usually macro.
But it's a
nice way of giving both our LPs and the folks that we, you know, are sort of in thought leadership circles with, you know, a sense of where we're at.
Very cool. Yeah, I do something somewhat similar. I mean, obviously I don't have those resources, but I just kind of more do a briefing on the upcoming data releases for the day and how those could right. play out and how markets are moving in five minutes or less is what I shoot for. But that's the daily contrarian, one of the benefits of premium subscriptions, but we don't have to talk about that now. But thank you all for listening. A very interesting conversation here with Mike Edwards. And we look forward to having you on again soon, Mike, you and others from your firm, hopefully. It's a nice little partnership we have going here.
That's great.
And with that, we look forward to speaking to you all again next week. See you then.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram.
send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.